Looking at his watch, he sees he's been walking for a good hour. His feet are beginning to get sore. He's alongside the colonist cars now, and there are all kinds of stalls selling food and clothing. People noisily compete for the potatoes, a pair of boots, a jar of spirits, a side of bacon. A woman in a spattered apron twists the neck of a chicken and begins to pluck it. Sausages spit on braziers. Soup pots bubble. Smells billow past him like steam from a locomotive. Near one stall, he sees a boy and a girl his age talking. Their bodies are angled expectantly toward each other, and when he looks back after a moment, he sees them kissing and then laughing shyly. The boy's fingers touch hers. Will hurries on. Where is Marin? It's such a different world from the perfumed hush of the first-class carriages. A dozen different languages graze his ears. He realizes he loves this. He passes a stall with a modest scattering of items, a rusty bottle opener, a compass with a cracked face, a few native arrowheads, and a pair of spectacles with cloth for lenses. What are these for? He can't help asking. Will only now notices that the man's eyes are milky with cataracts. His gaze goes right through him, and yet the man seems to know exactly what Will is talking about.
"Those are for the muskeg," is all he says.
Will feels the same chill he did last night when Mr. Dorian uttered the mysterious word. What he knows about the muskeg is this. It was nearly impossible to build tracks across it. Gravel and steel sank into the bog. An entire train disappeared once. His father told him stories of workers throwing themselves into the bog in despair, never to resurface.
"But what do they do?"
Will asks, picking up the spectacles.
"Put them on."
Will lifts them to his face. The cloth is very fine. He can still see, but only the outlines of things. The man before him is a pale shadow.
"Can you see my eyes?"
the man asks.
"No."
"That's right. You don't want to see the hag's eyes."
Startled, Will removes the glasses. "The hag?"
"She lives along the northern shores of Lake Superior. The tracks will take you right through. If her eyes meet yours, then it's too late."
"What happens?" Will asks.
"Oh, she'll just give a nod. And then it don't matter none if you look away. 'Cause next time you look back, she'll be a little closer."
"I'll be on a moving train, though," Will says with a nervous laugh. "Can she chase after me on a broomstick?"
"She doesn't need no broomstick. She travels with you."
The man grins, revealing stained stumps of teeth.
"When you first see her, she'll be standing just beside the tracks. But next time you see her, she'll be sitting right beside you on the train."
Goose flesh erupts across Will's neck.
"She'll sit beside you, nice and calm, and you won't be able to move or call out. Wouldn't do you no good anyhow, because no one else can see her but you. And you're helpless because you can't move and you can't stop her when she leans in nice and slow and whispers in your ear."
"What does she whisper?" Will asks, unaware that he is whispering himself.
"They say it's different for everyone, but some people, after they've listened a while, they get up and go between cars and throw themselves off. Sometimes they get run over by the wheels. Sometimes they roll and land in the bog and get pulled down."
"That's quite a story," says Will. The man shrugs. Will buys the spectacles. He walks on. The sun is out, and it's suddenly warm. He looks everywhere for Marin, even though he knows it's probably hopeless. There are just too many people. He buys a fizzy apple drink from a vendor. It's so refreshing, he has another. Beside the tracks, a man in brakeman's overalls calls out,
"5 cents to run the deck of the Boundless! The best and longest train in the world!"
Atop two boxcars, a pair of brakemen sprints back and forth along the running boards, jumping effortlessly over the gap. Will wonders if the conductor knows this is going on, but it seems a different world down here, far beyond first class, where the colonist cars give way to freight.
"Who wants a try?" brays the man.
"I do," Will hears himself say.
He's had no luck finding Marin so far, but maybe with a better view.
"Ah, the young fellow wants a try. I'll take that nickel and up you go."
Will grabs the ladder's thin metal rungs and hauls himself up as swiftly and confidently as possible. A short, wiry brakeman with pouchy eyes helps him onto the roof. Will likes being up high. He can see along the rooftop of the train in both directions. He figures he's about 4 miles from the station by now, though he can't even see it, nor any sign of the town. Forrest embraces the track. His gaze sweeps the crowded shantytown, looking for Marin without luck. Wind moves his hair, and for a moment he imagines the train is moving, carrying him with it to the horizon.
"Ever walked a boxcar?" the brakeman asks with a pouchy-eyed smirk.
"Nope, but my father used to be a brakeman."
"Was he now?"
the fellow looks at Will's clothes.
"He done well for himself, ain't he? Let's see how you do. Do a walk."
The running boards are no more than a foot wide, laid along the center of the roof. With the train at a standstill, it's not hard to step smartly along them. There's a bit of a crowd watching him now, but he tries not to look.
"Not bad," says the brakeman. "Try running it now, in them fancy shoes of yours."
This doesn't go nearly as well. He loses his balance a couple of times and steps off the running boards onto the roof.
"Lad!"
the brakeman calls from behind. He turns sharply. The fellow laughs.
"Look ahead! Never turn your back to the track. First rule! A sudden curve can send you flying."
Will nods sheepishly. He remembers his father telling him that. He can see a line of other people now, waiting their turns.
"You want to try a jump?"
the brakeman asks. Will looks at the gap. If his father could do it, he can do it. He backs up, sucks air through his nose, and runs. Looking straight ahead, he jumps, sails across, and clatters down on the other side. The second brakeman is there to steady him. Applause rises from the ground.
"You've got a knack, lad," says the second brakeman. "The union's always looking for new men."
The crowd below laughs. Will blushes, but he's proud, not embarrassed. He didn't feel scared when he jumped. He wishes Marin could have seen him. Not that it would be anything special to her, but still. He has one more look around for her before he climbs down. Outside, a canvas building, men and women are lined up. Through the doorway, Will glimpses a crowd perched on sawhorses, balancing tin plates of greasy food on their knees. Will's suddenly aware of people looking at him, and he supposes it's his fancy clothes. He removes his jacket and slings it over one shoulder, tries to slouch a little as he walks. Around a crude pen, cheering men are crouched, intently watching two roosters lash out at each other. Their claws are tipped with blades. The men trade paper money in coins, betting, urging the birds on. It makes Will feel a little sick, and he hurries away. From a makeshift saloon come squalls of laughter and shouting. Two men emerge, squinting and swaying unsteadily. With surprise, Will recognizes the portly guard from the funeral car and a brakeman in overalls. They seem the best of friends, slapping each other on the shoulders, rocking with laughter. Will is nearing the far edges of the shantytown now, and still the Boundless's freight cars go back and back along the track. Several miles, Mr. Beecham said. He can't even see the circus cars. He looks at his watch and is surprised at the time. He should be starting back soon. Why didn't she come to see the shantytown? To see him? With a sigh, he starts back, but he has to go to the bathroom. Looking around, he can't see anywhere obvious, and he doesn't want to go into the saloon. He'll go in the woods. Stepping amongst the trees, he looks back over his shoulder to check if he can be seen. Still lots of people milling about in plain view. He goes deeper, twigs crackling underfoot. The sounds of the shantytown begin to fade and then suddenly disappear altogether, replaced by birdsong. We'll make sure to walk in a straight line so he doesn't get lost. The forest is amazingly noisy. All sorts of things snuffling in the undergrowth. Some sound quite large. From his pocket, he takes the vial of Sasquatch urine and pops off the cork. He puts a drop on his index finger and dabs himself behind his ears, as he's seen his mother do with perfume. The smell is pungent. Better safe than sorry. He can wash it off before dinner. Behind him, he hears a grunt and turns in alarm. Half hidden in the bushes is a man with his back turned, peeing against a tree. He's muttering to himself, leaning against the trunk, more like clutching onto it for dear life. Then he steps back, drunkenly tries to hoist his trousers. He staggers, falls down chuckling, and takes two tries to get back on his feet. It's the guard from the funeral car. Will walks on a bit more and finds his own tree. He quickly relieves himself and then starts back to the tracks. Amidst the greenery, the silver keychain is easy to spot. Will bends to pick it up. It holds only a single key, unusually thick, with plenty of notches. At once, he recognizes it as the key to the funeral car. Same as his father's. The guard must have dropped it. Will pockets it. He is hurrying back toward the shantytown to catch up with the guard when he hears a grumble off to his right. Likely the fellow has fallen down again. Will wonders if he should tell his father. The guard's clearly unfit for his post. Will walks through the trees in the direction of the noise. Through the thick foliage, he catches a glimpse of the guard's jacket. "You dropped your key," Will calls, drawing it from his pocket as he steps into view. The guard is pushed back against a tree, his eyes wide with surprise. A second man has an elbow against the guard's throat and is pulling a knife from between his ribs. Will can't tear his eyes from the knife, darkly wet. He feels like he's been touched with something searingly cold. The man with the knife turns. Will recognizes the busted-up nose and the blue eyes that lock onto the key in Will's outstretched hand. Brogan runs at him. Will's terror breaks free inside him, and he bolts into the forest. Blood pounds in his ears. He ducks beneath branches, his face whipped with twigs, his ankles crackling through shoots and shrubs. He runs and runs, deeper into the forest. When he finally dares look back, there's no sign of Brogan. Pain spiderwebs across his side, and he can't run anymore. He slows down, looking all about, listening for footfalls over the noise of his own wheezing. Up ahead is a tree with branches low enough to grab. He drags himself up as high as he can. Hidden behind thick boughs, his breathing slows. His view is not good, but he can see around the tree for several yards. He hears nothing. He waits. Shivering, he realizes it has become much colder. The sun almost sunk below the horizon. He checks his watch. The second hand keeps ticking, but his heart skips a beat. It's almost 6 o'clock. He turns his head, straining for the noises of the shantytown, but he can't make them out. He has no idea where he is. The wind has picked up and shushes through the branches, making one of the loneliest sounds he's ever heard. And then, a single long blast of a train's whistle. The Boundless is getting ready to leave the station. He clambers down the tree, heedless of the noise he makes. He can't be left alone here, night coming on. That knife coming out, slick. He hits the ground running, hoping he's headed in the right direction. A second blast of the train's whistle tells him he's on course. He doesn't care if Brogan hears him now. He needs to get back on that train. But he didn't realize how deeply he'd wandered into the woods. With mounting desperation, he hurls himself through the thickets and undergrowth, waiting for the trees to thin, waiting for the sight of the Boundless on its tracks. Above his heart's roar, he hears the slow, rhythmic thumping of cars moving along the rails. It's leaving without him! He pushes himself hard, gasping. Some roots trip him up, and he hits the earth, one of his shoes flying off. No time to get it. Scarcely able to breathe, he runs on. A growing brightness between the trees. His legs surge with strength. Beyond the trees, boxcars shuttle slowly past. He breaks from the woods. There's no sign of the platform, or the shantytown for that matter. With increasing swiftness, the freight cars trundle past, and behind them comes the caboose, the last car on the Boundless. He pelts toward the tracks, toward the red caboose. Alongside now, he struggles to keep up. He sees the metal steps and the handrail of the platform and knows he has just one chance, for the train is gaining speed and his is failing. Grabbing the handrail, he feels its cold, hard pull. He looses his grip, takes it back. With all their strength, his fingers clench. Just before he's dragged off his feet, he gives a leap and lands on the lowest step. His knees nearly buckle. Every one of the four steps is a hardship, and then he is on the metal platform and falling back against the railing, breathless and numb. Chapter 5. The Caboose. Will has hardly taken three wheezing breaths when the red door of the caboose bursts open. All he registers is a pair of worn denim trousers, and then there's a hand clenching his collar and hauling him to his feet. Will looks into the furious face of a young man in overalls. "Not on my train!" the guard shouts, and with both hands he drags Will toward the platform's edge. Terrified, Will looks down at the ties flashing past.
"No!" he gasps. "Wait!"
"You hopped on. You can hop off."
"What's this?" asks another fellow, appearing in the doorway. This one is an older Chinese man with silver hair and an unlined face. His left pant leg flaps loosely and ends with a peg.
"Stowaway,"
says the younger fellow, and William feels the guard's fist clench. His eyes are slightly too close together. This and his sharp-tipped mustache makes his demeanor even angrier.
"Giving him the heave-ho!"
"Wait a moment, Mackie," says the other fellow. "He's just a lad."
Will can scarcely choke out the words,
"Not a stowaway! Passenger!"
And then after a few more gasps,
"First class!"
Mackie scoffs, and Will glances down at his own clothing. His jacket is shredded, and his trousers are grimy and torn at one knee. He lost one of his shoes. He doesn't look like a first-class passenger. He doesn't look like any kind of passenger. Even the people from the colonist cars are better turned out than he is.
"Where's your ticket, then?"
demands Mackie. Will swallows. He didn't even think to bring it with him. Just assumed they'd know him when he reboarded.
"My name's Everett,"
he gulps.
"William Everett. My father's James Everett."
"The general manager of the railway,"
says the Chinese guard, raising an eyebrow.
"He's just a hobo, Sticks," Mackie retorts in exasperation.
"Those aren't hobo clothes,"
Sticks says, looking Will carefully up and down.
"Just ripped and dirty."
"He's only got one shoe," exclaims Mackie.
"But it's a fine one," replies Sticks with a trace of a smile.
"I lost the other in the woods,"
Will murmurs.
"Stinks, too," says Mackie. "He's lived in them clothes a good long time." "It's just Sasquatch urine,"
Will says. Mackie frowns.
"What?" "To keep the animals away. I bought some at a stall." "The boy's an idiot on top of everything,"
says Mackie.
"Everyone knows that stuff don't work."
All the frantic energy that fueled Will through the woods and to the train leaves him in an instant. He feels sick and cold. His limbs begin to shake.
"He's gone pale," says Sticks. "Bring him inside."
Mackie lets out a bad-tempered breath, but turns Will toward the door and gives him a shove.
"You are likely chilled,"
Sticks says, ushering Will into the caboose and toward the pot-bellied stove.
"Sit there."
Will jerkily lowers himself into a chair and watches as the guard scoops in a few lumps of coal. It's hard to tell how old he is. He has kind eyes. A welcome warmth seeps from the stove, and William shivers. He didn't realize how cold he'd gotten in the woods. He puts his feet as close to the cast iron as he dares, leaning forward with his hands. There are several covered pots on the stovetop, one of them simmering slightly. A delicious smell fills the caboose. Sticks pours a mug of something and offers it to Will.
"Hold this without spilling?"
Nodding, Will gratefully takes the mug in both hands. For a moment, he just wants to feel its warmth against his fingers. When he lifts it to his mouth, he discovers it isn't tea, but some kind of wonderful broth. He drinks greedily. Styx takes a neatly folded blanket from a cot and drapes it over Will's shoulders.
"Thank you," Will says.
After a few minutes, as the soup's warmth spreads through his belly, the shivering stops.
"You're the Caboose Guard?" Will asks.
"I am. My name is Paul Chan."
Will shakes his hand.
"I'm pleased to meet you, Mr. Chan."
He glances over at the younger fellow, who's slouched in a chair with his arms crossed suspiciously.
"And that's hot-headed Brian Mackey," says Styx. "My brakeman."
"Thank you for not throwing me off the train," Will says.
Mackey makes a noncommittal grunt. For the first time, Will takes in his surroundings properly. Beside the stove is a wooden table. A shelf underneath contains pots and pans, and paper sacks of rice and onions and potatoes. Above the small sink and water pump are two shelves with some cutlery and knives and tinned goods. Farther forward, against either side of the caboose, is a small bed. Shirts and coats and trousers hang from pegs high up on the walls. In a far corner is a tidy desk, and above are a clock, a small mirror, and a bulletin board pinned with schedules and lists. At the very front of the car is a narrow door, which Will guesses must lead to the toilet, for he realizes these guards stay here for the duration of the trip. This is their home. Oil lanterns give the place a welcoming glow. There's a small square window on either side of the car, and even a couple of pictures pinned to the walls. Most intriguing is what's right above him. When he looks straight up, he can see a little observation room with windows on all sides, and two swivel chairs on platforms reachable by ladders.
"That's the cupola," Styx says, noting his gaze, "where we sit when the train's entering and leaving station, or being shunted, so we can make sure the tracks are clear of obstruction."
Will thinks that if circumstances were different, he might ask to climb up and sit in one of those chairs.
"We were just settling down to our dinner," says Styx. "Are you hungry?"
"Not what you're used to in first class," says Mackey sourly.
Styx takes some bowls from the shelf. He lifts the lid of the largest pot and ladles out a stew thick with carrots and potatoes and onions and peas and parsnips and cubes of beef. He passes a bowl to Will with a spoon. Will holds it in his lap, just staring at it. Last night, he ate lamb in first class, but right now, he's not sure he's ever smelled anything this good. Greedily, he begins to eat.
"Guess they're not feeding them too well up front," says Mackey.
"Quiet, Mackey,"
Styx tells him with calm authority. He tears a big hunk of bread from a dark loaf and passes it to Will.
"Mop up with this."
Will wipes the bread around and around the bowl and devours it all. He appreciates it with an intensity he didn't feel in the first-class dining car. He notices everything, the grainy texture, the yeasty flavor.
"Thank you," he says gratefully.
A few melodious notes float through the air, and Will looks up inquisitively.
"My wind chimes," explains Styx. "Hanging out back. Now, William Everett, suppose you tell us why you're on my caboose."
With food in his stomach, Will feels restored. He begins to tell his story. He avoids Mackey's hostile eyes and looks at Styx instead, who regards him patiently and nods every now and then, and even chuckles quietly when he hears about how he bought the Sasquatch urine. When Will comes to the part about seeing the drunken funeral car guard in the woods, he hesitates and doesn't mention the dropped key. He knows what that key does, and he trusts Styx, but not Mackey. He can feel the key still in his pocket. Then he tells Styx about the guard being stabbed. Will notices that Mackey is leaning forward slightly in his chair.
"This fellow with the knife," says Styx softly. "Did you get a good look at him?"
Will sees the knife in Brogan's clenched fist pulling back, wet, and he feels a queasy swell in his stomach.
"He was in Brakeman's clothes. His name's Brogan."
"There ain't no Brogan on this train,"
Mackey says to Styx.
"Are you sure he was in Brakeman's clothes?"
Styx asks Will. Will is less sure now.
"Well, they were overalls."
"Anyone can wear those," says Mackey.
"Describe him," Styx says.
Big, but not too tall. Fair hair. And his nose had a kink in it, like a break that hadn't healed proper.
He knows he should have said properly, but thought it might sound prissy alongside all the blunt talk of the caboose men. He likes that talk, the sound and shape of it. He adds,
blue eyes.
You notice the color of his eyes?
Mackie asks.
I've seen him before.
Styx's eyes widen.
When?
In the mountains. He tried to steal the last spike.
Mackie gives a caw of laughter.
And I suppose you drove the last spike, too.
I did,
said Will, tired of Mackie's sneering.
Crazy and a liar,
Mackie scoffs.
I seen that photo of the last spike, and you are not holding the hammer.
I wasn't in the photo, Will says, because Donald Smith bent the spike,
Styx says, nodding.
I've heard this story. They said a boy drove it in. So,
he looks at Will.
That was you.
Will nods.
And this Brogan,
Styx says,
what happened to him up there?
He got attacked by a Sasquatch, thrown over the cliff. Everybody thought he was dead.
You believe all this, then?
Mackie asks Styx.
I do. I've been around people long enough to know a liar. This boy is not lying.
We'll find out, I suppose,
says Mackie.
I doubt this Brogan fellow works on the train, though,
says Styx.
There's all kinds of rough sorts hanging about the junction.
Will looks at the clock.
How will I get back?
Well, says Styx, the Boundless is more than 900 cars long, and it's a good 5 miles before you even get to colonist class. It's no easy stroll over the top of freight cars unless you're partial to jumping in the dark.
Will knows the Boundless isn't scheduled to stop until tomorrow afternoon.
If your father's the general manager,
Mackie says,
why don't he just stop the train for you?
He won't even know I'm gone,
Will says, realizing.
He's driving the Boundless.
Then he'll know there's a freight close behind us, and the Intercolonial not far after,
Styx says.
Stopping's out of the question. We can't be blocking the whole track, and there's no siding long enough to hold us. Most likely, you're stuck with us until tomorrow.
Well, ain't that a joy,
Mackie mutters.
Mackie, says Styx, another unkind word from you, and you can sleep on the roof tonight.
Might prefer it, the stink coming off that boy.
Wash the dishes. After that, I want you to take a note up and tell the fellows to pass it forward.
To Will, he says,
we can work a message to the front, to the conductor. There's a brakeman every 20 cars.
The fellows won't like it,
says Mackie.
Not in the dark.
We've got a straight stretch for a good while,
Styx says.
Easy for you. You won't be the one up top. And it looks like there might be rain.
Right now there's a full moon. Plenty of light. Anyway, this is important. If a guard's been murdered, they need to know about it. Especially if the killer's on the board.
Will's insides clench.
You think he might be?
Could be. But there's a Mountie aboard who will sort things out.
It's Sam Steele,
Will says, trying to make himself feel better.
There you go. No one finer than Samuel Steele.
Styx walks over to his desk, picks up a pen, and starts writing a note. Reluctantly, Mackie gets up and pumps some water into the sink, sluicing the dirty bowls and cutlery. Will remembers a sink like that in his old apartment before they were rich. He sees a dish towel and steps forward to help.
My father used to be a brakeman,
he says to Mackie. Mackie grunts.
Then you know it's pretty much the most dangerous job in the world, especially in bad weather. Them running boards get all slick. Rain drives into your face, you get a sudden rumble or curve in the track, you slip and get thrown.
Before he can stop himself, Will glances at the peg jutting from Mr. Chan's floppy pant leg. Then he looks away, but not before Mackie has caught him out.
Nah, he didn't fall off,
says Mackie.
He was blasting in the mountains with the nitro. Got his leg blown clean off. Least he survived. Gets to work inside now. Not like us. You know there's 5 brakemen killed every day across this continent?
The boy doesn't need your sob stories,
Styx says sharply,
and neither do I. For every mile of track we lay through the mountains, 4 of my countrymen died.
Styx hands a sullen Mackie an envelope marked with the Boundless insignia.
Get going and take that forward.
I'll see if anyone's heard about this funeral guard,
says Mackie. He pulls his jacket and cap from the pegs, takes a lantern, and leaves through the forward door.
Don't mind him, Styx tells Will. He has indigestion of the soul. If he were my son, I'd have let wolves raise him.
Will smiles. He feels a lot better knowing his father will be getting a note about him, and the guard, and that Sam Steele will know too. He looks around the caboose and up through the cupola windows, where he can see the full moon. The idea of spending a day in a caboose doesn't seem so terrible. In fact, he likes it. He could do without Mackie, but how many people get to cross the country in a caboose? It's almost as good as riding in the locomotive. He isn't even aware that his eyes keep closing until he hears Styx say,
"Why don't you get some rest?"
Will nods. He feels unaccountably heavy.
"You can have my cot," says Styx, "but if you don't mind, have a wash first. That Sasquatch urine is potent."
"Sorry," says Will, walking unsteadily toward the front of the car.
Behind a small door, he finds a tiny wash basin and a hard bar of soap. He scrubs at his face, especially behind his ears, until his skin is chafed.
"There you go," says Styx, nodding at the cot.
Will is touched that he's folded down the sheets for him. Will takes off his shredded jacket and vest, then sits down and removes his only shoe. It feels strange settling into someone else's bed. His head sinks into the pillow. He pulls the blanket around his neck. Against his face, gentle heat pulses from the stove. The sound of wind chimes wafts in from outside. The mattress is a bit saggy, nothing like the firm comfort of his bed in first class. But then the motion of the train, like some rough lullaby, works on him. And in moments, he is asleep. Chapter 6. An Unscheduled Stop. When Will opens his eyes, it takes him a moment to understand where he is. He hears the musical trill of wind chimes. Beyond the caboose windows, it's still dark. He sees Mackie in his cap and jacket, lantern in hand, talking quietly with Styx at the desk.
"Why have we stopped?"
Will asks, sitting up. Styx and Mackie both turn.
"There's a slow freight ahead of us," Styx says. "We're waiting for it to be shunted so we can pass."
"Did my father get the message?"
"It'll be working its way up," Mackie says.
Hopeful, Will asks, "Is there enough time for me to make it up front?"
"Could be. We were just going to wake you," Styx says. "Mackie's going to walk you up to the next guard, and they'll take you from there. You might make it all the way. Worst case, you'll bunk in a guard cabin. I'd take you myself," he taps his wooden peg, "but I'm a bit slow."
"Get your shoe on," Mackie says to Will. "Be quick about it."
Hurriedly, Will ties the laces of his single shoe. Without the blankets, he feels the cold again and shivers as he pulls on his vest and jacket. He's vaguely disappointed to be leaving the caboose. It's cozy, and he likes Styx. He was looking forward to the stories the old guard might tell. He tries to brush off the dried mud his trousers have left on the bedsheets.
"Never mind that, lad," Styx tells him.
"Thank you very much for your kindness," Will says.
The caboose guard claps him on the shoulder.
"You're quite welcome, lad. Quick now, and with a bit of luck, you'll finish off the night in your own bed."
Mackie is already leaving by the forward door, and Will hurries after him, out onto the platform and down the steps to the gravel. Despite the moon and stars, the night is startlingly dark. It takes him some minutes for his eyes to grow accustomed. His feet crunch in the gravel as he walks past one dark boxcar after another. Far in the distance, he thinks he hears an impatient hiss of steam from the Boundless's engine, or it might just be the sound of the wind in the trees. He has no idea where they've stopped, or even what time it is. He forgot to check the clock before he left. He hurries to keep up with the sullen Mackie. From the glowering wall of forest beside him emanates an oppressive silence, broken occasionally by a fierce scuffle of leaves. He thinks he catches the flash of eyes low to the ground. Mackie seems not at all concerned and just keeps walking.
Do you think there's bears in the woods?
Worse, probably.
Mackie doesn't even glance at him.
Saw a wendigo around here once.
Will's skin crawls.
Really?
Luckily, we was moving at the time. Threw itself at a cattle car. Nearly ripped the door right off.
Will walks faster. The train stretches ahead in a long, slow curve. At regular intervals, red lanterns hang from its side. Will remembers from his father that the brakemen hang red lanterns when the train's been ordered to stop, to send a signal all the way down the cars. When the train gets underway again, the lantern lights are green. After a few more minutes, Will sees a bright white light up ahead. This one swings.
"There he is," says Mackie. "He'll take you on."
Will can't say he's disappointed exactly, but he feels a bit apprehensive about meeting a string of strangers in the darkness. The two of them pass a few more freight cars. Will can see the other brakeman's tall silhouette. Will still isn't used to his lopsided, one-shoed gait, and when he stumbles on the rail ties, Mackie takes his arm to steady him.
"It's the young gent," says the other brakeman, walking to meet them.
"The very one,"
Mackie replies. In a sudden splash of lantern light, Will catches sight of a shadowed face with a nose that looks like it's been broken one too many times. Will's throat clenches.
"But..."
He looks at Mackie in terror. He backs up, ready to run, but Mackie's grip tightens on his arm.
"That's him!"
Will cries. Swiftly, Brogan strides toward him. Something clenched in his hand flashes darkly. Will tries to wrench his arm free. Why won't Mackie let him go? And then some desperate instinct springs inside him, and he throws his full weight against Mackie. The brakeman staggers, nearly dragging Will down with him, but Will twists free. Half-blind, he runs back toward the rear of the train. He has no breath to shout for help. Brogan's boots crunch in the gravel behind him. With his one shoe, Will is clumsy, and he can barely see his feet.
"Key's all I want," gasps Brogan. "Give me that key, boy. I'll let you live."
Will knows he's lying. He casts a wild look at the woods, 5 yards to his left, and doubts he'll make it in time before Brogan catches him. On his other side, the train is an unbroken wall, but for the gap beneath cars. The quick puffs of Brogan's breath are getting louder. Will gives himself no more time to think, just throws himself under the train. The steel rails punch the breath from his belly as he lands atop them. Head against the gravel, he scrabbles furiously, the smell of creosote sharp in his nostrils. He's halfway through when a hand seizes his ankle and drags him back. He digs his fingers into the gravel, then grabs the rail and holds tight, kicking. His second shoe flies off, and he hears a curse as his foot connects with Brogan's face. Twisting, he kicks out again, but Brogan grips his ankle and hauls him backward. Will plunges a hand into his jacket pocket and grabs the vial of Sasquatch urine. With his thumb, he forces out the cork. Half the contents slop onto his hand as Brogan gives another violent jerk, but Will splashes the rest of the liquid into Brogan's eyes. The brakeman curses and lets go to swipe at his face. Obscenities fly from his mouth. Will is free and hauling himself out onto the other side of the train. He figures he has only a matter of seconds before Brogan comes after him, or Mackie vaults over the couplings between cars. But for these few seconds, Will knows he can't be seen. He sucks in a breath and in his stockinged feet runs full tilt away from the tracks. He hurtles through the wild grass and scrub and is among the trees. He crouches low. Peeking out from behind a trunk, he sees a misty beam of lantern light stab the darkness. The beam sweeps up along the train, then down, and then Will hears a muffled curse. A second lantern joins the first. Mackie and Brogan murmur together. Mackie, the scoundrel, knew all along. He and Brogan are in this together. And Styx? How could he not have heard of Brogan? Unless Brogan changed his name. Will holds his breath, praying they won't come looking. Mackie runs toward the back of the train, Brogan forward, both jabbing their lights like spears between and underneath cars, searching for him. As swiftly as he dares, Will pads through the undergrowth in the direction of the faraway locomotive, letting Brogan stay well ahead of him. Will wants to keep moving. Who knows how long the Boundless will stay here? If he can make it as far as the passenger cars, he can dash on board. Once he's among other people, he'll be safe. Without his shoes, he feels lighter, glad at least to be moving in the right direction. He's never known darkness could have so many shades. The sky, the train, the woods, the ground underfoot. He keeps an eye on Brogan's lantern up ahead and then throws himself to the earth as the beam swings suddenly toward him. Will can't believe how far the lantern light reaches, and so powerfully. Like a living thing, it seeps over the forest, and Will scuttles backward and presses himself against a thick tree. The swath of light edges closer, illuminating a rotted log, leaves, a crone-shaped bush that crooks a finger at him. The light is briefly eclipsed by the trunk Will hides behind, and continues on the other side before hesitating. Will holds his breath. The light seems to be getting more intense, joggling slightly, and then he hears the footfalls. Brogan is coming. Will doesn't dare make a run for it. All he can do is stay here and stay still. Twigs crackle. A lantern handle creaks. Will thinks he can hear Brogan breathing. He imagines his lantern in one hand and the knife in the other. Abruptly, the light goes out, and Will almost gasps. For a few agonizing moments, he is completely blind, completely helpless. Silence. He needs to breathe, but waits for retreating footsteps that don't come. He knows Brogan is just standing there in the darkness, waiting and listening. Will must breathe. Through his mouth he inhales a small draft of air. To him it sounds like a wheeze. He bottles his breath and listens harder, trying to divine the location of Brogan. His temples throb. A single footstep. Then a second. Will's pupils dilate. He can't tell if the footsteps are getting louder or softer, for everything in the night forest is amplified. Will sits forward, ready to bolt, already plotting with his panicked animal eyes a path deeper into the woods. Farther away. The footsteps are getting farther away. He sinks back, tugging air into his lungs. He risks a peek around the tree, sees the killer's silhouette in the swinging light as he makes his way back toward the train. Hunched low, Will hurries forward. He knows there are other brakemen posted along the train. There's a bunk cabin every 40 cars or so. He could run to them, call for help, but how does he know he can trust any of them? Another sickening thought breaks across his mind. The message to his father. Mackie wouldn't have passed it on. There will be no help coming. He keeps going, wanting to get as far as he can. In the distance come two short blasts. He knows the signal well. Train leaving the station. He breaks into a run. He can't be left behind in the middle of nowhere. But what if he jumps aboard and meets another murderous brakeman? Up ahead, he sees a red lantern turn green, then one after another down the length of the train. All the lanterns go green. Couplings creak as the cars give a forward tug. From within the forest, something moves. Will looks over his shoulder and sees nothing. Undergrowth crackles. He remembers what Mackie said about the Wendigo and runs. In the moonlight, the boxcars glide past, picking up speed. They have no platforms, no steps, only a set of rungs on the side, near the rear. Will locks his eyes on the closest set of rungs. With a burst of speed, he grabs for the lowest one. The thin, cold metal bites into his palms. Kicking off, he reaches higher and slams his feet onto the lower rungs. When he looks back down the train, he catches a distant flash of light, a lantern held by someone leaning out from a freight car. Will pushes himself flat. If he hasn't been spotted already, he soon will be. Just around the corner of the boxcar, on the back, is another set of rungs. If he can get to those, he'll at least be hidden in the space between cars. But moving is the last thing he wants to do. He grinds his teeth. What has he done? He can't cling onto a boxcar forever. Cold wafts from the boxcar as though it were an icebox. His hands are numb, his limbs exhausted, but he knows he has to move. Releasing one hand from the rung, he reaches around the corner of the car. His fingertips find the rung and close around it. Then, swiftly, before his courage fails, he leans back and swings his whole body onto the other set of rungs. Gasping, he presses his face against the cold metal, willing his arms and legs to stop trembling before they shake him off the train altogether. He waits, the judder and rumble of the train melding with his pulse. There is no door back here. It isn't like a passenger car. Sooner or later, he'll be discovered. Or fall. He has to move and keep moving until he reaches a passenger car or Circus Dante. He remembers the circus train is back here somewhere, nestled amongst the freight. 80 cars they have, that's what the conductor said. The rungs lead up to the roof of the boxcar, and he can make out running boards jutting over the edge. Just hours ago, he ran along them, but the train was still then. And now it's moving at 40 miles an hour through darkness. 5 men killed every day. He climbs a couple rungs, one more, and his head is sticking up above the roof. He takes a backward glance, and his throat tightens. The lantern is a faraway white dot, and he can't tell how quickly it's moving, but he knows it's headed in his direction. The train gives an unexpected jolt, and Will's feet are nearly jarred from the rungs. He faces forward, breathing hard. Go! On the roof of the boxcar is a single handle to the left of the running boards. He takes hold, heaves himself up onto his belly, and slithers onto the boards, gripping them tightly. There is a constant shimmy to the train, an impatient forward surging. Will is afraid to stand, and drags himself forward on his belly. But it's no good. He'll be overtaken in minutes this way. He gets to his knees and crawls, slowly, for he's very tippy. The boxcar's roof slopes gently away on either side. It would be so easy to roll right off. When he takes another backward look, his worst fears are confirmed. The lantern light is definitely bigger. Has he been spotted already? The train banks slightly, and he nearly loses his balance. Look ahead! Never turn your back to the track! He has to get up. He plants one foot on the running boards, raises himself into a sprinter's start. Quickly, he stands, knees bent, arms out. He will not look down to the sides, only forward. One step, then another, his feet mere shadows in the moonlight. The dark outline of the running boards is his only guide. Cold air pushes against him, and he has to lean into it for balance. The faster he walks, the less he teeters. At the end of the car, he looks down into the noisy, churning gap. He's not ready to jump. He'll climb down, cross the coupling, and then go back up. But when he kneels and turns to descend the rungs, he sees Brogan's lantern, closer still. Its light is pale upon Will's clothing. No time to climb. Once more he stands and takes a few steps back, squinting to check that the train isn't turning. He jumps. He locks his eyes to the running boards, lands, stumbles, but doesn't fall. He keeps going at a steady jog now, his body parting the wind, the night forest hurtling past on either side. Brogan's powerful lantern beam hounds his legs like an attack dog. Will jumps again, keeps running, counting cars in his head. 5, 6, 7. He squints, then blinks. It's like part of the sky is blocked out. Then he realizes that before him, rising like a wall, is a double-decker boxcar. Will pulls up short, panting. How does he do this? He knows he's out of time. He steps back, takes a wild jump, and clumsily catches hold of the rungs. One of them strikes him hard on the cheek and sends bright sparks of pain through his head. He keeps climbing. On the high roof, he feels the train sway more strongly. As it rounds a curve, he crouches for safety. He notices that the lantern light no longer dogs him. For a few moments, he's invisible. But Will doesn't know how much longer he can keep this up. Eventually, Brogan will catch him. And then what? A quick tussle, a thrust of the knife, and his body tossed off the train. The mere thought makes him feel faint, and he very nearly falls into the hole that suddenly yawns before him. He jerks back. Cut into the roof is a large rectangular opening. No way he can jump across. On one side, he sees a skinny running board, perilously close to the boxcar's edge. One false step, and he'd be over. He shuffles toward it. He really does feel like a tightrope walker now. Something thick and rough brushes his ankle. With a yelp, he looks down and sees it slither past his leg and disappear into the darkness of the hole. A hot whiff of animal rises up to him. He moves as quickly as possible, but suddenly a shape undulates before him like a giant cobra. It sways, its head a toothless gaping hole, and sends a snort of rank air into his face. Will staggers and falls. His hands uselessly claw the empty air. And the dark snake hooks around his waist and plunges him through the hole in the boxcar roof. Even as Will hollers, he's aware of some vast shape in the darkness, and he understands finally that this creature twisted around him is no snake, but the trunk of an elephant. A thick layer of straw rustles beneath his feet as he's set gently down. The trunk releases him, and the tip prods his body inquisitively.
"Thank you,"
is all Will can think to say. And then jubilantly, he realizes, "Zirkus Dante! These must be the first of their animal cars. He's never been so close to such a large beast. He could trample him by casually lifting a single foot. Who's to say it won't?" Will wishes he had something delectable to give it. It pushes against his pocket, and Will remembers the sugared almonds. He takes out the mangled paper bag and holds it up to the elephant. Its trunk deftly slips inside, extracts the last few nuts, and carries them to the shadowy regions of its mouth. Will hears a satisfied chewing sound. A beam of light plays across the hole in the roof. Will staggers into a far corner of the boxcar. Hastily, he throws straw over his legs and torso and sinks back. A figure appears at the edge of the roof. Light stabs down. Will holds his breath. For the first time, he sees the elephant properly, its ancient, mottled gray skin and its big, patient eye, dilating with the light shined into its face. It makes a disgruntled sound. Its trunk arches up and, with a flick, knocks the lantern from Brogan's hands.
"Cheeky beggar," Will hears Brogan mutter. "I'll give that trunk of yours a hiding. I know you're down there, boy, and I'm coming for you."
In the moonlight, Will sees the elephant's trunk flex and shove the man. There's a thud against the roof and considerable cursing as the elephant pummels Brogan, barring his passage. Will leaps up. At the front of the car, he finds a low door. It takes him some time to figure out the latch, but he manages and swings it inward. The noise of the track clatters against him. He steps out onto a narrow platform. There are no railings here, just a wooden gangway shuddering atop the great iron coupling. It's just a few feet across, but Will hesitates. Somehow, this is scarier than jumping across roofs. The tracks are so close. He steps onto the gangway, feels the deep vibration of the train's metal bone and sinew pass through him, and jumps the rest of the way. He grabs hold of the handle of the next car, opens the door, and ducks inside. More animals. He can tell from the fog of straw and excrement. High up, a few windows let in starlight. Almost the entire car is an enormous cage, with only a very narrow corridor running down one side. He presses himself against the wall as he pads along, trying to keep away from the bars. A low feline growl wafts up from the darkness, and he quickens his pace. From the corner of his eye, he sees a shadow of movement. Low to the ground. Stripes. Bengal tiger. Will reaches the end of the car, opens the door and crosses again, noticing that the sky is starting to lose its darkness. The next car is divided into stalls, and he hears the comforting sounds of horses nickering. How far does he have to go before he finds people who can help him? The following car holds monkeys, which set up a terrible shrieking when he enters. After that is a large open pen of camels, which smell terrible. There are no cages, and he has to walk amongst them. Most of them just sit and watch dolefully as he passes, but one stands up on its ungainly legs and produces an appalling, rattling call. When Will enters the next car, he knows right away there is something different about this one. There are no windows at all, only a few small, grilled vents high up. Before he closes the door, he sees that the bars of the cage seem thicker and more closely spaced. The corridor is a little wider. The smell is different, too. skunky, cloying. He walks quickly. From the cage comes a surprisingly light patter of footsteps. Fear crackles across his back like brush fire. The train sways violently and Will bumps against the bars. A hand closes around his wrist. Will chokes on his own cry, coughing for air. He tries to pull free, but the fist tightens. He's aware of something very tall on the other side of the bars. A face looms from the darkness. It's the eyes he first notices, far more intelligent than most animals. The face is long and lined, bordered by dense hair. All the terror that has been dormant in Will since the avalanche is suddenly wakened. Will pulls again, but the Sasquatch tightens its grip and pulls too, so Will's face is smacked against the bars, right next to the creature's. He can feel the hot air expelled through its nostrils. "Please," Will says. "Get back!" a voice shouts, and Will looks over. A young man with a lantern and a stick walks toward the cage. "Let go, Goliath!" Will feels the Sasquatch's grip loosen, but not release. He sees its hand clearly now, twice as big as his, the fingers long and leathery. It stands taller than Will. On its left shoulder is an angry line of raised scar tissue. "Now!" The young man bangs the bars with his stick, and the Sasquatch finally lets go. Will falls back against the wall, his mouth parched with fear. In the wash of lantern light, the Sasquatch squats and rocks on its haunches, staring at the man balefully. "That's good, Goliath," he says. "Good." From his pocket, he takes something and tosses it at the Sasquatch. Almost dismissively, the creature picks it up, sniffs it, and puts it in its mouth. The young man turns now on Will. "What the blazes are you doing here?"
"My name's Will Everett," he says hoarsely. "And someone's trying to kill me."
Chapter 7. Zirkus Dante. Will is unceremoniously marched through one dimly lit car after another. The young man has yet to tell him his name. In fact, all he has said is, "Mr. Dorian will want to hear about this." Will assumes this young man must be one of the Zirkus's animal handlers. He seems grumpy, and Will supposes he's to blame for waking him up. That camel's rattle was certainly loud enough. The animal trainer wears loose-fitting trousers and a vest. He can't be much older than Will. Though he's not as tall, the trainer's shoulders and arms are more muscled. On his left forearm are twin scars that look like claw marks.
"That Sasquatch," Will says. "Is that the one Mr. Dorian caught in the mountains, when it was just young?"
The young fellow glances at him.
"How do you know that?"
"The scar on his shoulder," Will says. He's so relieved to be with someone who isn't trying to kill him.
"I was there. I saw it get stabbed."
"Are you the animal trainer?"
"Assistant animal trainer," the fellow mutters.
"What's it like?" Will asks.
"The Sasquatch."
"Smart."
"Are you training it?"
"You don't exactly train a Sasquatch. He lets you think you're training him sometimes. He's cooperative, so long as you don't annoy him. Sometimes I think all he wants is escape." Will has lost track of how many cars he's passed through. He looks about. On either side of the corridor, thick burlap curtains conceal berths. The hallway is humid with the smell of people sleeping. Clothing hangs from any old place. Pegs, hooks hammered into the ceiling, makeshift clotheslines.
"Something smells bad,"
rumbles an angry voice from one of the lower berths.
"Really bad."
A curtain pulls back, and from the berth emerges a body so huge that it seems impossible it could all fit inside. When the man stands, his head nearly hits the carriage roof, so he hunches forward, making his shoulders and chest seem even more massive. The giant points a carrot-thick finger at Will.
"He must be thrown off the train,"
the giant says matter-of-factly. He tilts his head as though pondering how best to fold Will up.
"I cannot bear that stink. I will throw him off now."
"No, wait! It's just Sasquatch urine,"
says Will as the giant steps toward him.
"I can wash it off."
"Mr. Beaupré has a very sensitive nose," says the animal trainer, without any apparent concern for Will's welfare.
"Let's just wait a moment, Mr. Beaupré, shall we?"
says a compact fellow springing down from the upper berth. A handlebar mustache is the only hair on his bald head, and he is dressed like he's ready to do gymnastics. He winks at Will.
There'll be plenty of time to throw him off the train, but maybe first we should find out a little more about him.
I see no point in waiting, Mr. Beaupré says.